From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Thousands of scientists plan to march on Washington this weekend.
Some of the best scientists in the world are in the federal government.
Plus, bringing bees back to Georgia cities and walking with endangered penguins in downtown Atlanta. First, though, please just take a couple minutes of your time to support this show. We are in the middle of our spring fund drive, and you can go to gpb.org and click donate or call 800-222-4788. It is easy, it is quick, and it is so important if you value good journalism in Georgia. Before he was elected, President Trump called climate change a hoax. Now he's rolling back policies that are meant to lower greenhouse gas emissions. Georges Benjamin says combating climate change is a public health issue. He's the executive director of the American Public Health Association. He joined us in February, along with Peter Dykstra, the publisher of Environmental Health News.
I want to just settle something right at the beginning before we continue, and that's the so-called debate over climate change, which I want to be clear is not a scientific debate. But here is then, at this point, still candidate, not yet president, Donald Trump, in an interview with the Miami Herald, and he's dismissing research behind climate change.
Many years ago, I believe it was in the 1920s, they talked about the phenomena of global cooling. They thought the planet was getting cooler. Now they think the planet is getting warmer. Nobody knows for sure.
Peter, nobody knows for sure. Can you answer that?
I want to speak specifically to the global cooling nonsense, because that's just got to go away. I'm going to turn 60 years old next month. The possibility of global cooling was raised in the scientific community about 2 weeks before my senior prom. It's alarming to see climate denial alive in the cabinet, in charge of House and Senate committees, and in the White House. We're the only country in that status in the world, the only one.
Why, George, why are you addressing climate change as a public health issue? How is climate change affecting health?
More people having asthma attacks, big heat waves put our health at risk. A warming environment brings vector-borne diseases closer to home than ever before. And just think about the severe storms and the number of people that have been injured or killed with the increasing frequency and severity of the storms that we're having. If it hurt people or kills people, it's ours. And that's why the public health community is concerned about climate change in our health.
Another thing that the National Climate Assessment pointed to were respiratory problems and then this possible spread of disease because of insects. What is that danger?
Well, think about it. You know, we know, for example, mosquito-borne diseases. We just spent a whole year worrying about Zika. And, of course, that's a mosquito-borne disease. And the fact that those as the weather gets warmer and wetter, you'll have more mosquitoes. So things like West Nile virus and dengue and Zika and other mosquito-borne diseases we call vector-borne diseases are more likely to happen in those communities.
So, Peter, let me play you another comment from the president. Again, this is from his interview with the Miami Herald in August.
Certainly climate has changed. You know, they used to call it global warming. They've had many different, they call it extreme weather. They always change the name to encapsulate everything. The problem we have is our businesses are suffering. Our businesses are unable to compete in this country because other countries aren't being forced to do what our businesses are being forced to do.
Okay, he makes two arguments there, Peter. Let's deal with the first one, which is his idea that they're constantly changing the name.
Climate change and global warming have been used interchangeably for a long time. It's not a conspiracy. There are different ways to define not what's going to happen, but what's already happening. And there's been an effort to paint this alleged name change as some sort of conspiracy theory. Looking at the science, that just doesn't wash. One metaphor I like to present about this is back during the days of the ill-conceived Iraq invasion and Iraq war, Dick Cheney, the vice president, put forth a theory that even if there's a 1% chance that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, they didn't, but even if there's a 1% chance, we have to take decisive action. The denial is so deep that it seems we're denying even a 1% chance that what the vast majority of the scientific community in the world is telling us is true. And it could be extremely costly to the business community, to the general public, and to folks who live along the shoreline in places like Mar-a-Lago.
So then let me put the second half of Donald Trump's comments to you, Dr. Benjamin, because it sounds like he's saying we can't, even if climate change is a threat to public health, we can't put regulations on because that will make it impossible for our businesses to compete. What's your response to that?
If you did, you can't have a business. If you're sick, you can't have a business. It's nonsense. You know, first of all, the green industry, which is rapidly growing and creating jobs, is a very important component of our emerging economy. Secondly, there are many things that we can do to reduce your own individual carbon footprint. Business community, by the way, is not buying this. The business community has already adopted the fact that we need to adjust for climate change, and it's actively working in that area. But the fact of the matter is that we need to make sure that the air is safe to breathe and the water is safe to drink. Otherwise, there's really no reason to have a business because we'll be too sick in our environment.
Peter, what kind of fear is there among the scientific community that there could be censorship, especially in light of some of the ways in which federal scientists have been silenced or at least threatened with silence?
Well, and web pages have disappeared. Climate scientists being threatened or harassed or sued or Freedom of Information Act requested within an inch of their lives is nothing new. This has been going on for a long time. I don't think folks are aware of just exactly how much political, ideological, possibly financial pressure the science community is under for just doing its job on these issues.
Let me put the same question then to you, Dr. Benjamin. Do you feel as though there is a fear among the scientific community that there could be backlash for this kind of research?
Yes, the fear is there. But, you know, one of the things that you know when you've been in public health, and as long as I have, is that fearing something doesn't mean that the problems aren't going to go away. Bad news does not get better with time. So a warming environment, the fact that we have emerging infectious diseases, the fact that we have severe weather is going to be here even if we pretend that climate change doesn't exist and is here today. And we're going to have to respond to it. So no matter what you call it, whether you have to call it emergency response to severe weather or emergency response to emerging infectious diseases, climate change certainly is here, and we're going to have to respond. And by the way, this administration, as if they're serious about protecting the health and well-being of the American people, don't have to worry about little terrorists coming into the country, because Mother Nature, Father Nature is a terrible terrorist, and we're seeing that with climate change. There's Department of Defense agencies that are doing climate change research because they have to do that in order to defend this country. So this is not something that they can put their head in the sand and pretend is not going to happen. They're going to have to be involved in climate change, whether they like it or not.
That's Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association. You also heard Peter Dykstra, the publisher of Environmental Health News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Bees play an invaluable role in our ecosystem, but they're slowly dying out as a species, in part because of human activities. The Urban Honeybee Project at Georgia Tech hopes to create new homes for these insects while educating students on ecological responsibility. Georgia Tech's Jennifer Levy is director of the project, and we spoke with her last year. So let's talk first about one of the reasons that I have to assume they even have something called the Urban Honeybee Project is because of colony collapse disorders, which has been going on for quite some time. Can you explain for all of the non-scientists in the world what colony collapse disorder is?
Sure. So for a number of years, probably since about the mid-2000s, it's been noticed that more and more honeybee hives are dying every year. So it used to be about 15% colony loss per year. This last year was the very worst, with over 40% of colonies being lost in the
worldwide.
That's in the United States.
But that's been, I know that we've seen similar numbers in other countries as well.
Oh, sure. It's everywhere. And it's due to a number of different factors. People gave it this sort of mysterious name, colony collapse disorder, when they weren't exactly sure what was causing it. And now we know that it's a multifactorial cause. It's a combination of disease, especially the very dangerous Varroa mite, which spreads viruses between colonies. and pesticide exposure and loss of habitat.
So to put this in perspective, just so people can understand how catastrophic it would be should we lose our honeybees. I read a fact where they said one of every three bites of food eaten worldwide depends on pollinators, and that's especially bees. Is that true?
Right. Well, that's an estimate, but bees are very important for pollinating all kinds of crops, and in fact are essential for a lot of the crops that we enjoy in the United States. The almond groves in California, for example, can't be pollinated by the native pollinators in the area, and they actually have to truck in millions of beehives every year in order to get good almond yields in California. So bees pollinate fruit trees, nut trees, other crops like melons, tomatoes.
So what's the difference between an urban bee and a rural bee?
That's a good question, and that's what we're asking at Georgia Tech. So we wanted our students to address an important and relevant question while they were studying science. And so we placed some beehives on like a four-story roof at Georgia Tech, right in the center of campus, and asked, how do bees fare in urban areas, especially honeybees? So we have students that are investigating whether honey produced in urban areas is more contaminated with pollution, because that's a possibility. We're also asking genetic questions. So students taking our genetics lab are looking to see whether queen bees that are mated in urban areas have any differences from those that are produced in rural areas, where most queen bees come from. And I don't know. We haven't seen huge differences so far. Our bees do pretty well in the city.
Let me try to address some common misconceptions about honeybees. Mm-hmm. The first is that people are concerned about having hives near them because they're afraid everyone's going to get stung. What's the truth of that?
Well, bees are busy. They're primarily interested in collecting food and bringing it back and taking care of their young. So as long as you're not opening a beehive, you're pretty safe. And as long as you're not standing directly in front of the entrance of a beehive, you can actually, if you find a honeybee on a flower away from a hive, you can get very close. You can sometimes even let it, you know, crawl on you, just like you would let a fly crawl on you. Some people like to pet them. They're only going to sting when they're...
I try not to let flies crawl on me, but continue.
Yeah. They only sting when they're defending something like their babies or their food stores.
And so, then they die if they sting.
They do.
You.
They do. Honeybees do. That's right.
Right.
Wasps, like yellow jackets, which is Georgia Tech's mascot, of course, they can sting multiple times because their lifestyle is different. They're actually carnivores, so sometimes they sting their prey. But honeybees are herbivores. They just like pollen and nectar. And
they're the peaceful.
They are.
Peaceful, yeah. giants. In,
tiny giants.
little insects of where it was the wasp. You know, there's been some bad things said about wasps because they can be so aggressive. So tell me about what kind of things. We already talked about whether you're trying to find out how urban honeybees behave, whether there's any difference in their honey. Are there other things that you're trying to research and get data on?
Yeah, one of our big projects is trying to develop technologies to study bees. So as you would imagine, Georgia Tech is a place where we have lots of computer scientists and engineers, and we have quite a number of projects going where students are developing technologies to monitor bees remotely, for example. So you can tell a lot about a beehive by measuring the weight of a beehive. And that's not such an easy thing to do unless you happen to have a digital hive scale that can send data to the internet, and then you can, you know, download that data and interpret it. So,
but that means you have to go out to wherever it is and put the hive on a scale.
Yeah, you would need to put the hive on a scale, but we're working on ways to do it so that once you've put it on the scale, you don't have to go out on a regular basis and
collect the batteries.
Yeah, or replace the batteries. That's right. Battery technology is key to this.
Do we really have an idea? I mean, there's a lot of wild bees, are there not? So do we actually have an accurate picture of how many honeybees there are in the U.S.?
There are some pretty good estimates on how many commercial beehives there are, but depending on the state, some states require that all beekeepers register their hives and others don't. So we don't have good estimates on how many hobbyist beekeepers there are. And in the Metro Atlanta area, there are a lot. So we don't know exactly how many there are.
So how has this worked? Do the students get attached to the bees?
Oh, yeah. We have lots and lots of volunteers. Some students like to work with the beehives, and then others like to do projects that don't necessarily involve hands-on work with the bees. But we have a lots of students who are pretty attached to the bees.
Pretty fond.
Yes. We have one hive that was actually collected from a swarm. So coming up pretty soon is going to be swarm season in Atlanta, which is when, you know, as the queen bees start laying eggs around this time of year, the population starts to increase in beehives and the colonies split. That's the way that the colonies reproduce.
That's Georgia Tech's Jennifer Levy, director of the Urban Honey Bee Project at Georgia Tech. It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Atlanta might be the last place you'd look for endangered penguins, but every morning at the Georgia Aquarium, there is a waddle walk. That's when staff takes endangered African penguins out for a walk around the aquarium. GPB intern Olivia Reingold joined them recently and brings us this audio postcard.
My name is Jennifer Odell. I'm the curator of marine mammals and birds at the Georgia Aquarium. Right now what we're watching is a penguin waddle training session.
We're doing our training.
My name is Amy, and I'm a trainer here at the Georgia Aquarium. I work primarily with our African penguins. So I have here today with me Dapper, who is one of our penguins that was hatched here at Georgia Aquarium, and he is 2 years old. Dapper is a pretty laid-back penguin, so he is one of our main birds that comes on the waddle with us. I think that the waddle serves as a great connection for the guests and the penguins. It's definitely one of the cutest things they'll see all day here at the aquarium.
Okay, so what do you guys think? Is it cold in there or is it hot in there?
Cold!
Why?
Cold!
Why?
Because the habitat is cold.
The penguin's habitat is cold. Nice job, Kavya. Very nice. Nice job.
I think they are cute. I think they're cute.
I think they're perfect.
I think they're nice.
They got habitat.
So today we are very fortunate to have a lot of school groups here on site at the aquarium. This is always a really popular exhibit for them.
My name is Megan Fisher. I'm a public relations coordinator here at Georgia Aquarium. African penguins are an endangered species. They can be found in more temperate climates off the coast of South Africa, and they're endangered for a number of different reasons.
You know, we look at a lot of different things. One is the human interaction with the Earth. We know our seas are changing, temperatures are rising, which is causing food sources to move further offshore, making these birds have to really look for their food in different places that they're not used to going. My name is Roger Montiel. I'm the manager of guest programs.
All right, guys. Well, it looks like it's about time for African penguins, and here they are.
So our African penguins, along with their trainers, are making their way down our ramp here in the atrium here at the aquarium, showing off for our guests. There's a lot of people taking pictures, oohing and aahing at their adorable waddle walk that they're doing.
Oh, they're so cute. They're smaller than I thought. Can I pet it? So cute. It's different than what I thought it looked like.
Shiny.
Yeah.
My name is Barbara, and this is Maria. We just saw the waddle walk, and she wanted to pet them, but they don't allow you to pet them. But what'd you tell them, Maria? Come here. What'd you tell them?
I like penguins. They're so cute.
All right, well, we're happy penguins. We're making our way back home.
Happy Earth Day. Hi, my name is Jared Brody. I host the Penguin Waddle. If it's not even African penguins, just when it comes to your own environment, your own community, if you see some trash on the floor, pick it up. Those little moments like that makes a big difference. We only have one planet Earth. Let's try to take care of it while it's still here.
That piece was produced by GPB intern Olivia Reingold. And now, let's talk some trash. The City of Atlanta announced earlier this year it is the test pilot for a new software-based trash pickup system. Atlanta became the first partner of a waste management company called Rubicon Global. And Rubicon says this program will cut costs for the city and help combat climate change. Stephanie Stuckey-Benfield is the Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Atlanta, and Michael Allegretti is the Head of Public Policy for Rubicon Global. We spoke to them in January. So, Michael, help me understand how software changes the way you pick up. I mean, you'd think that picking up trash is just going down each street and picking up the garbage where there's bins, right? So how does software change that?
Well, you know, you can't improve what you can't measure. So at the end of the day, this is really about moving this industry, the waste and recycling industry, out of the dark ages and away from a landfill model, which is an opaque model, where knowing how much waste you produce, when it's produced, and what's in it isn't advantageous to the business. Moving away from that to a model where citizens and governments and businesses actually understand how much they're producing and where the opportunities are to recycle and reuse materials, not just to help the environment, but also to make money. So at the most basic level, data and analytics and transparency help to move us away from landfills and towards a greener future.
Stephanie, what does that look like in realistic pictures on the streets of the city?
So there will be no discernible difference for the regular Atlanta homeowner as to how their trash is picked up. What the Rubicon Global Project brings for City of Atlanta residents is that we are going to start measuring at a real granular level our trash and our recycling. And as a result of that, we hope at the end of this 6-month pilot study period to come up with some solid recommendations for how we can be more efficient.
Meaning you're going to measure how much really belongs in a landfill, how much is recyclable. You also know how much people are recycling as opposed to throwing into their garbage?
That's right. And the cool thing about this technology is right now we have data based on quadrants, which is how we schedule our pickups. So we have different pickup days for the different quadrants.
Divide the city into squares. And
exactly.
Yeah.
So we just have quadrant level data. This gives us data per individual household. And especially what we need to know is who's recycling.
I got to stop you again. You know, if I live in Atlanta, you're going to know whether I'm recycling or not.
That's right. And we're not trying to be the trash police. What we're trying to do is encourage people to recycle. And we can't really target the homes where people are not recycling unless we know who's not recycling.
Right.
So this data is going to enable us to be more effective in our communications and our outreach strategy.
That's Stephanie Stuckey Benfield, Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Atlanta, and Michael Allegretti, Head of Public Policy for Rubicon Global. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Back to our conversation about a project in Atlanta that might reduce what the city spends taking out the trash and, in addition, help combat climate change. Michael Allegretti is the head of public policy for Rubicon Global. Stephanie Stuckey Benfield is chief resilience officer for the city of Atlanta. How do you do this, Michael? I mean, how do you know which addresses are recycling? Because they all get thrown into the same bin, right? I mean, how do you separate people's trash by address?
So the tech, it's app-based tech. So essentially all 60-plus Department of Public Works trucks in the city of Atlanta will be outfitted with our technology on a smartphone. And the principle of the tech is interaction by exception. That's what's so cool about this company and about this technology. It was developed through the eyes of the men and women on the front lines slinging trash bags and driving trucks. So as the truck's rolling down the street, based on a number of things, and we have dozens of patents pending and approved, they combine GPS, the change in hydraulics of the truck, various shaking mechanisms, all these different triggers essentially confirm that a service has taken place. But if a driver sees something when he or she goes to remove the trash that's out of whack, let's say a bin that's contaminated or it's overflowing, they can actually record that in real time right on the app and have a digital record of that.
Stephanie, what other things can you imagine using this kind of, that's a lot of data, right? I mean, I would imagine there's a lot of different uses for it. For example, maybe there's a household that doesn't realize that you can recycle certain kinds of plastic and they were throwing them away. Is that the kind of thing that you can actually learn?
That's right. And so we want to be able to more effectively communicate to Atlanta residents what they should and shouldn't be recycling. So this data will be incredibly informative in that regard. We're also looking at route maximization. So are we really doing the most effective routing of our trash trucks? So that is the type of technology that Rubicon brings to the table. What's really innovative about Rubicon Global, unlike other trash hauler companies, is that they have a zero waste goal. They're not in the business of owning landfills and making a profit out of how much trash you can bring to the landfills, which is how most waste management companies make their money. Rubicon Global wants to divert waste from the landfills. They want to get more waste in the recycling stream. And so we're improving our greenhouse gas emissions, and we're improving our quality of life. So we're really excited to be partnering with Rubicon Global. They're also, I've got to give a shout out for City of Atlanta. They're an Atlanta-based business.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about trash, and I'm speaking with, tell me your new title again.
Chief Resilience Officer is part of Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities program.
That's a long title.
I know. But it's an exciting title. We'll have another show on that.
Stephanie Stuckey Benfield. Atlanta is the test pilot for a new software-based trash pickup system, and so we have Michael Allegretti with us from Rubicon Global, who developed that software. So, Michael, I have to think that I'm not the only person who is thinking, are we entering the era of the trash big brother? Like, how far is it? How far away are we from Atlanta knowing that I'm not recycling, that I just tossed my aluminum can into the garbage, and then somebody showing up, the trash police showing up at my door saying, all right, pay $5 for not recycling your Coca-Cola can?
All right, well, fair enough. You see, the issue is, right now, Atlanta already knows that. The difference is they can't communicate with you about it. They don't have the means to be in touch, to kind of track that, and to start to change your behavior for the better of the city. So knowing about it's one thing, but knowing about it and being able to do something about it is where the change is happening. And, you know, for us, this, as a company, the Rubicon Global story up until now has been one about small business empowerment. We have about 5,000 independent haulers across all 50 states, and we work with them to service small, medium, and big national customers who want more cost-effective and environmentally sustainable solutions for their waste. But now with Atlanta, the story evolves. It goes to a new chapter about government efficiency, smart cities, resilient cities, responsive cities. It's really about, if you're going to have a tax dollar paid, you need to get the full value of that dollar back through a service. And I like to think that the Rubicon software in this partnership will kind of maximize the value of that tax dollar.
How do you make money doing that, though? Because, look, I can't even recycle my glass anymore because they said it's not profitable. So I have to throw glass, one of the most easily recyclable materials on the planet, sure, into the garbage. So how do you make money without using a landfill?
Celeste, a lot of that has to do with the messenger. If you're speaking to a landfill company, and the big incumbents in the industry own dozens and dozens of landfills that they need to fill in order to be profitable. So the math for them isn't going to be the same as for a company like ours, who's out there basically looking at all of our customers and saying, give us your trash. As our CEO and founder, Nate Morris, says, trash is a tremendous opportunity. The key is to have a lot of it, and to have it sanitized, and then to sell it on the secondary markets.
Stephanie, what are some of the biggest mistakes people make with their garbage? Is it that they're not recycling all the things that they can recycle, or what are the biggest educational opportunities, I might phrase it that way, for the average consumer?
The biggest problem we're seeing is contamination and failure to recycle. So those are the two.
So you're not rinsing out their recycling items? Is that what you mean?
No, it's people putting items in the recycling bin that don't belong there.
Like batteries.
The number one, batteries is one, but the number one item that people throw in the recycling bin that they shouldn't, can you guess?
Styrofoam.
Plastic
diapers.
Bags. Plastic bags.
Oh, grocery bags, yeah.
Yes, people think that plastic bags are recyclable, and it's what I call magical recycling or wishful recycling. People think, oh, if we put it in there enough, eventually it will be recycled. The problem is plastic bags are not recyclable through our recycling system, and I don't know any city that does recycle plastic bags as part of their single-stream residential pickup.
But there are cities that don't allow plastic bags anymore.
That's right.
They want you to use reusable.
We're not there
bags
yet. I certainly encourage people to use reusable, but we're not banning plastic bags at the city level yet.
That's Stephanie Stuckey Benfield, Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Atlanta. You also heard from Michael Allegretti, Head of Public Policy for Rubicon Global.